What is body literacy?
Body literacy is being in tune with and in touch with your own specific body, being aware of and having the language for it and the desire to be on the journey with it.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Molly Caro May about her memoir, Body Full of Stars, Female Rage and My Passage into Motherhood. This discussion includes frank language about anatomy and bodies, which may be unsuitable for young or sensitive ears. There's a line that you write, "Imagine if the world was made up of people fluent in their own bodies." What would that world look like?
I think very peaceful. I think we would have the capacity to move our emotions through our bodies, which we really don't as a collective right now. And with that, all these rage, anger, sadness, anxiety pieces would have a place, but also be transmuted. So I think peaceful and vibrant.
What do you mean by our emotions are getting stuck in our bodies?
Well, for women in particular, we haven't really had the opportunity to voice, or the safety to voice, anger. You know, other emotions are more accepted, but it's because of that, we suppress and tamp down these emotions and they get stuck. And really, they're human emotions. So if we learn how to move them through the body, feel them, process them, release them, it sounds so simple. I think it's more complicated for those of us who don't have the tools than our body's working how it's meant to.
So the title of your book is Body Full of Stars, Female Rage and My Passage into Motherhood. And Molly, when I was preparing for this interview, I caught a glimpse of my own internalized reaction and was like, we can't talk about postpartum depression and can't talk about pelvic floors and female incontinence on the radio, you know? That's unkind to listeners. And I was wanting to know right off the bat, how did you muscle your way through any of that own sort of like background noise about permission to do this?
I have, for some reason, my parents have been always generous with me in terms of my ability to voice what I need to voice. And so I think that background really helped. I'm white, I'm heterosexual, I'm American, I'm cisgendered, I'm middle class. So I have a platform and a safety that a lot of people don't have. So for me, it wasn't a huge risk in that way. Sure, there's embarrassment. There are some scenes that I have these sort of waves of shame when I think about certain people reading them. But I also felt like it was really critical because behind closed doors, I was talking to friends who had similar issues or happenstance. And I felt like it's time to really discuss. I just talked to a friend the other day who said that she was reading my book in public and she had that same feeling like, uh-oh, yeah. Are people going to think I'm rageful if they see the title? So it's in us. We have this fear of being seen as angry.
Yeah, so I'm really curious about the word rage and not anger. Mm-hmm. Why rage?
Because I think rage is something that comes over, at least for me, comes through the body and takes over the body in a moment, in an instant. Anger for me feels sort of pervasive, not low tone, but constant tone. And for me, my anger / rage was linked to my menstrual cycle. So right before I bled, it would just come on in this huge wave and often not instigated by one thing in particular. And so it was super biological. It was also situational, emotional, all those pieces. But rage feels big, feels tornado, feels explosive, and feels for me ancestral. So the rage I was feeling was mine. It was also my mother's, my grandmother's, and all the women beyond.
Can you say more about that ancestral rage?
Right. I think as I was on my journey, I kept asking myself, what is this about? I could name a few particular things. Right. But then I would have these moments where I was feeling something that was not mine. And sort of exploration of it, I came to understand that, you know, there's a lot my grandmother was pissed about and she never processed or digested. And it got passed down to me, it got passed on to my mother. There's a lot that women I'm not related to by blood have felt. We're all connected. And when I think a group has been quiet or silenced, we all carry that. So that's where that came from.
Do you feel like you're a lightning rod?
Oh, gosh. Yes, I hope not, though, in some ways. I felt like when I was writing this book, I had a very clear awareness of a whole chorus of women calling out to me, not because I'm special and not because I have a special story, but just because my art and my craft is writing. And so this is what I'm this is the story I'm telling. So I was very conscious of it being my process, but also something that is in the collective consciousness. It's ready to rise now. And when I was writing it, the whole female anger, female rage thing was not in the media.
Right.
And so, and I had a couple of people say to me, you know, you got to be a little careful because you're going to really turn a lot of people off. And look where we are now.
I want to know, what is your invitation to the readers who might feel excluded by this, you know, who haven't born children or who won't, or who are men or who, for whatever reason, aren't really into the body literacy element? How would you invite them into the book?
Great question. Well, first I would say we all came out of a vagina or out of a C-section. So we're all connected to it on some level. I have had a lot of women who aren't mothers read it and respond and say they related to the whole body piece. And they're all doing Kegels now, or they're all trying to strengthen their pelvic floors. And because that's important, it's not just about motherhood. It's about connecting to this creative source that all women have, that we are supremely disconnected from as modern people. And for men, you know, my husband's story is big in here. And I think that, talk about not talking about it, that does not get discussed, partner's story. And so that would be my invitation to men. And I also think there's an invitation to women of an older generation who might feel distanced or afraid of this topic because it's unearthing something that they didn't have the safety to feel or even talk about feeling. But I'm not alone. I am not the first woman on the planet to feel some rage, and I know that.
Speaking of the timing of the book, when did you finish this book and how did you coordinate writing it as you were, you know, becoming a mother?
Well, I didn't really start to write it in full until my first daughter was 2.5. So I was taking notes the whole time. I knew that I was going to create some sort of art out of it. I didn't know if it would be an essay, a book, I don't know, a performance. But when she was 2.5, I got a residency and I left for 12 days. And I wrote the first draft in 12 days because that's what you do when you're a mom and you don't have any time. So I just, you know, muscled through it, banged it out. It was profound to do that. And then I just did it hour by hour here and there. And I completed it right before I got pregnant with our second daughter. Mm-hmm. And that was intentional because I have pregnancies where I vomit for 10 months. So I knew that I needed to complete it. And during that pregnancy, I edited and shifted and I sold it 4 weeks after she was born. So,
wow, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. I want to hear you read about rage.
Okay. What I learn. Rage is a circuit that starts in my pelvis and moves out two openings, my urethra or my throat. No wonder the screams, the urine. It is mine. It is also part of a greater current of all women, women like me, women of other races, cultures, languages, and terrain. It is our push back toward the institutional violence we've grown up in. It spews outward in response to patriarchy. If I am an angry woman, women of color must feel it 100,000-fold. We have unsimilar experiences held in the similar container of femaleness. Beneath it all, for all women, is grief. Can you hear the wail? We have a voice too. Our body is sacred. Do not defile it. We have been unseen, disrespected, shut down. Leave us alone. But the strangest indoctrination happens. Rage also turns inward toward each other. Violence from women toward women. Who does she think she is? Look at her. We inhabit the system that breaks us. I have directed my own violence toward my mother, the woman who made me. It's an easy and safe anger. It stands in for what we've been taught. Violence toward self and our own female body.
There's another section in the book when you talk about women relating over their own brokenness. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that in the context of this grief and rage?
Mm-hmm. I think that's the first step, is to relate over brokenness. That's the vulnerability piece, you know, moving together and saying, yes, I experience this as well. And, you know, let's sit in it together. But then it can become sticky, sort of soupy, mm-hmm. and we stay there in our victimhood. It's easy. I think women are really good at saying, come on over, let me give you a hug. Let's bash our husbands, or bash this, bash that. And there's a purpose in that. But then there's a point where you arrive and realize, you know what, this is not serving me to stay in this place. Mm-hmm. And so let's uncover a new sort of resilience. It doesn't mean that you can't have moments of defeat, but I think calling each other toward like a radiance is important.
You also tie in your own history into the book, and you talk about your first memory and call it part of your body mythology. Like, how would you describe body mythology to the general public?
Well, I think we all come into the world with a birth story and with a parent story, and we're told things about our body, whatever it may be. And then we grow into this awareness of, you know, where we came from and who we are physically and how the world responds to us. And then we move into the world with the desires of our body, whether my desire was to climb trees. I just wanted to be really physical and hang upside down. And so for me, body mythology is the story of our body and how it's journeyed, how it's broken free from what it's been told, and found its new and authentic ground.
If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Molly Carroll May about her book, Body Full of Stars. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the next segment, Molly addresses the relationships and partnerships impacted by postpartum depression. As mentioned earlier, listener discretion is advised. You live with your parents for a while in the book, and I want to understand how living with your mom shaped this process in the book for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we lived in their guest house, which was about 50 yards away from their house, while my husband was building our house. And it was everything and all above, all of the above, meaning it was such supreme comfort to have my parents there. My mom in particular, she's a beautiful cook. She's just super present. She allows me my feelings and is very hands-on. So she sort of was the net and picked up a lot of the slack where my husband left some holes. And I think that's how it's supposed to be. Turns out, I think we're really supposed to live in these, you know, nuclear homes with just one person and have a baby and then hang out by yourself. I mean, it's supposed to be a village. And I really learned that. So I had the benefit of that, and a lot of my friends didn't. The challenge with that is that being in such proximity to my parents, every childhood wound or upset I've ever felt was right in front of me while I was becoming my own mother, or becoming a mother. So I'm deciding how I want a mother while I'm living with my own mother. And so I was triggered all the time by everything, trying to define who I wanted to be.
I've heard that from some of my mother friends, that becoming a mother reveals all the old woundology, if I can use your term. You know, and I was wondering that for you, like, if it was hard to hold both of those places at the same time.
Yeah, you know, because you enter into parenthood wanting to right all the wrongs of your own experience. And we all do that. And I think the beauty of that is that every generation gets sort of closer and closer to more of an authentic relationship. And but that's part of the learning, and that's how we're all teaching each other. So I know already, my eldest daughter is almost 5, and I know I'm making mistakes here and there, and she's going to have to figure out if she chooses to have kids, if she's going to do what she's going to do differently from me. And that's important. That's part of individuating.
Speaking of the mother-daughter relationship, there's a point in the book where you talk about maybe your worries about your daughter imprinting on this rage. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, what does that look like now, you know, mm-hmm. 5 years later? Like, mm-hmm. is there some solace to give mothers who've gone through postpartum depression and worry that they've somehow, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. done damage? Or
it's a really good question. I still think about that all the time. Was my daughter imprinting on me? Yes, I believe so. I mean, how can your kids not imprint on you? They're picking up on your energy. They're picking up on your tone of voice. Is that bad? No. I mean, I think it's really healthy for our kids to see our range of emotions, because it teaches them, as long as it's safe for them, that's an important caveat, as long as it's safe for them, it teaches them that they too can experience these emotions and that it's normal. And so something I've done a lot with my daughter as she's come into more of her voice, we talk about, you know, how to manage anger and frustration. And she's got it too, just like all kids. And so in my parenting of her, I'm learning how to parent myself. So simple phrases like, it's okay to be angry. You can't hit me though.
Yeah.
You can hit your pillow. I have to say that to myself. It's okay to be angry. You can't blame it on your husband.
Right.
Go into your room and take a breath. And so in parenting her, I'm really calling myself into this deeper action, like really trying to do the work instead of just say it.
Right. Can you take us to a scene where we get to hear your daughter's voice?
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Mama, Eula says one day when she bumps into me at the front door. I've never heard her say sorry, and it bothers me that she says it in this context. No need for that word so overused by women. I bend down and put my arm around her. You don't have to say sorry, you just say excuse me, I explain. I realize excuse me has its own set of issues, but the word sorry frightens me. It's the gateway drug to all the other words women use to apologize for their own existence. Clearly, I say it often. Sorry I was late. Sorry I didn't tell you. Sorry, sorry, sorry. In our early days, Chris used to say, babe, you don't have to say sorry when you tap me on the shoulder to ask me a question. I need to erase it from my weekly vocabulary. I want to preserve it for when I really mean it. Eula nods. Later that afternoon, Eula runs through the house. Her bare feet tap, tap the concrete floor, and she sings, sorry, 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 as she glances back at me with a grin. Oh, girl. I don't respond, but love her defiance, this feedback loop. When I start saying, excuse me, she will follow.
In the next paragraph, you write, our language is the language of the dominant culture. So how do you think we begin to untether ourselves? I mean, one way, you already describe it in that section, but what else?
I really think it starts with language. And people will say, oh, language is so simple, but it is so profound. One thing, I don't even know if I write about it in the book, but snowman. Why is it snowman? I'm so tired of snowman.
Yeah.
Can we just talk about snow people or snow women? And you really have to work at that. And my daughter said snow woman forever, and then she went to school.
Mm-hmm.
And now snowman is what she says, because that's what's everywhere. So now think about that. That is profound. So for me, starting at language is critical, including the she pronoun. And now we're moving into there, which is really interesting and like dynamic. So it's all going to shift, which is super exciting. But language for me is a starting place.
Where do you see this book fit in the conversation about gender expression?
Well, I talk about that a little bit in the book. You know, I named it Female Rage, knowing that people would ask, you know, why is it female? Why? And it's not women's rage. For me, it's female because it's located in the biology of the body, of the female body, regardless of how you identify.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you have a body that has a uterus and you bleed every month, that's a particular body with a particular set of hormones. And that's that. I think that's really critical. And the female body is engineered to move emotions through it. I mean, people used to do this. Red tent. You hear about the red tent. Women would sit for their communities and bleed and move the emotions through the body and move the emotions of the community. That was their task. And so we have this masterful system that we don't even use.
So what's your advice for women out there?
In terms of what? Just life or in terms of just connecting to this?
Yeah, connecting to this.
Mm-hmm. I think I really believe in choice. So if a woman decides she doesn't want to connect with her menstrual cycle, so be it. I'm not going to tell anyone to do that. But if a woman is interested, that I would say that's your first place, you know? Consider a way that you can connect with it authentically, off of hormones, and learn about how it moves, and then read about it and sort out the way to create a rhythm and ritual for your life. So when you're bleeding, you're divine. I mean, you are channeling. You are channeling all sorts of stuff in your life. That would be a time to take some pause so you can receive what you're channeling. And that sounds super woo-woo and out there, but what I really mean is it's true. You are connected to everything around you in a deeper way. So pause, even if it's for a day. You know, and after you bleed, you've got big energy. Send out projects, do big stuff, build ideas, get your work going, connect with your partner. And then after you ovulate, you know, you're slowing down and you're in this space of really needing to self-care. I mean, I think if we all got into that ritual, the whole world would be way calmer.
And what do you say to the critics, you know, who would argue, but you have to show up for work and you have to have the same amount of energy every day and you have to
do. Totally. And yeah, because we live in a society that's been structured by the patriarchy. So we show up to work and we work 80 hours a week or more. And there's a reality there. People have to put food on their table. I get that. But I think that within that system, there are ways to subvert it. So if you're at work and you're bleeding, you know what? You bring your special tea or you take a longer lunch break or whatever, or you take a sick day for half day. I think there are ways to incorporate it. I do. But I wouldn't say, you know, let's all go live in the woods and not work. You know, I understand the reality of all of it.
What do you wish was told to you before you became pregnant?
I wish someone had said to me, the first years of your children's lives will be the hardest on your marriage, and it's okay, and you'll move through it. Mm-hmm. Don't consider divorce. Don't attach to the idea that your marriage is broken or your partnership is broken, because you're in a channel, and it's squeezing you tight, and you will emerge. I really wish someone had told me that, and I tell that to parents, not to scare them, but to say, hey, you're going to be sleep deprived probably, and it's going to take a toll. But you will find each other again, and just try to be gentle. I really wish someone had told me that. And then in terms of the body piece, I was aware of my pelvic floor before I was pregnant, but I didn't think anything was going to happen to it. And so I think I wish I had been taught from a young age the art of self-care. And that's a buzzword we hear all the time. But what I really mean by that is placing myself first, period.
Not that you can speak for him, but what's the guidance or advice for men who are watching women go through this, whether it's sisters, wives?
Mm-hmm. I mean, from my perspective, I would say validate the woman. Just, you know, remind her. I mean, that's all I wanted, right? The whole book is about me wanting my husband to say, I see you, essentially. Not the whole book, but that part of the book. Mm-hmm. And I think women have been unseen for so long for everything they do, for pregnancy, childbirth, raising kids, all that. It's been sort of assumed in the same way that men have been unseen for, quote, providing for eons. And obviously those systems are all shifting. But I think that would be the first thing, you know, honor your person, honor your woman. And then also, you know, take care of yourself. If you're the partner, you got to take care of yourself, because your woman needs you. Yeah. So does your baby. And so somehow you have to take care of yourself and just ride this journey. And please know that you're not alone either. And if there's any way to reach out to other men, other partners, that's beneficial. That has been huge for my husband when he hears another man say, you know, man, you're just not going to sleep for 5 months. Something shifts in him.
Mm-hmm. Thinking of the craft elements of this book, the prose is broken up with these like one-line lyrical fragments. It's almost like there's embedded poetry. And I'm just sort of curious, what was your instinct around those lines?
I think part of it's my style. I like to write with long, endless sentences and then give a short punch here and there. And I am a poet. I mean, that's what drew me to writing in the first place. The pleasure I get from writing is, you know, in playing with language and figuring out how words go together and how they sound. So for me, it's really oral, listening to the sound of words. And because I feel like this book has a huge message, there were some lines that I really needed to isolate and have them be standalone paragraphs so that the reader would see it visually and see it as this isolated thing lifting off the page.
And how did your editor and publisher roll with it?
They're great. My editor is a man and who's not a father, and he very funny sense of humor, and he had to rein me in here and there. Mm-hmm. And that's helpful because I'm an overwriter as opposed to an underwriter. And so there were places where he would say, you know, this is too much, this metaphor. You've got three metaphors going on in the sentence. You got to rein it in. And I appreciated that. But there were places where he would say, you know, I think this is a little too much blood in the scene. And I would say, you know what, man, sorry, you don't get to make that call. You're a man. And he would go, okay.
I think the last question I want to ask you is, what is your body song today?
Such a great question. Well, I have a second child and she's just 13 months. So I've been sort of in my second postpartum period, a similar pregnancy, a much better postpartum time, but not without challenges. She just started sleeping regularly. So I've been sleep deprived for a year. So I think my body song now is in some ways really future focused. And I don't mean that in that I'm not present to it, but I have this real awareness that I am at a point now where true physical healing is available to me now that I'm done having children. I'm not going to have any more children. And so I knew after my first daughter was born that there was going to be this lag time. We wanted to have a second. And now I feel like freedom.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to stop nursing in a few months. My hormones are going to regulate and I will essentially have my body back for the first time in 6 years. And so that is very exciting. So my body song right now is there's this deep well of patience and awareness and knowing that something really profound and potent is coming my way.
Molly Carol May lives and plays in Bozeman, Montana. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.